This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have an update on Julian Assange and Bradley Manning. We'll hear about an Occupy the Justice Department action for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we'll also talk about the Immokalee workers' fight against public supermarkets.
Julian Assange and Bradley Manning continue to do the right thing, truth tellers for all. Mumia, now off death row and in general population, fights for his exoneration. And the Coalition for Immokalee Workers goes against another supermarket, Publix.
We're joined by attorney Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights to hear about how a judge dismissed a lawsuit that was designed to force a food co-op in Olympia to rescind its boycott of Israeli goods.
A great victory, particularly during Israel Apartheid Week.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I find that the most recent WikiLeaks downloads the intelligence information most fascinating.
It is quite amazing. Starting on Monday, WikiLeaks began publicly displaying and talking about and giving to its 25 partners, not one, not two, but 5 million emails from a company called Stratfor in Texas. We don't know where they came from. There were some earlier documents that Anonymous actually surfaced about Stratfor. Stratfor is a global intelligence network, private. We call it, or people call it, a shadow CIA. What it does ostensibly is if you are a company, and this happened, if you're a company like Coca-Cola and you're getting trouble from people who are PETA, for example, which was giving Coca-Cola some issues, they hire people like Stratfor or organizations like Stratfor, private surveillance firms, private analysis firms, to do an analysis of what they're doing.
Basically, what we're seeing is a partnership between the private sector and public law enforcement.
I think that's right. I think you're seeing that because they're looking at these groups that are doing protests. And
they're calling them probably fringe groups, threats to domestic security, and they're really, in effect, multiplying the capability of gathering data on activists.
So these private groups are hired by various corporations. Interestingly, this one, Stratfor, is actually hired also, apparently, by the Department of Homeland Security, the Marines, and some other U.S. entities. So they don't just have this private function, they're actually working with the U.S. government. And even worse than that is these are revolving doors between people who've worked for the U.S. in intelligence or counterterrorism and then who work for Stratfor. So the key vice president, who is responsible for what we're about to talk about, Fred Burton, used to be a counterterrorism official with the State Department and the Department of Diplomacy looking at protection of diplomats and other things and counterterrorism.
And now he's in the private sector.
Now he's a vice president of Stratfor. So WikiLeaks has started to download 5 million documents. You can look these up on WikiLeaks sites. You can get them everywhere. But what I really want to focus on today a little bit is what those documents have said about Julian Assange. There's a series of documents. Julian Assange in WikiLeaks is mentioned hundreds, maybe thousands of times in the documents. Look at this, 5 million documents.
And let me ask you this, because I haven't looked at them myself. When you call them up, is his name highlighted, or do you have to just do a search?
They're not that long. These are emails.
Oh, okay.
They're not that long,
right.
The documents. So you can, if you go to WikiLeaks sites, you'll find them quickly. Normally, for most WikiLeaks documents, there was a search mechanism you could use. I'm not sure that the Stratfor documents yet have a search mechanism. They have the number they put up. It's only on the WikiLeaks site. It's only a couple of hundred so far. So this stuff is going to keep on rolling. But what brings us really and brings me particularly now to focus on these documents is the Center for Constitutional Rights and myself are advisors to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, legal advisors. And we've been particular advisors about the Bradley Manning trial. And we'll talk about that for a second. I was at the Bradley Manning trial last week just for the arraignment. But it's all related to this. So in these documents, in the Stratfor global intelligence documents, there's one document from Fred Burton, who's the vice president, former U.S. official, counterterrorism official, that says, quote, "We have a sealed indictment of Julian Assange," end quote. Keep this private. He did this in January 2011, just over a year ago. And of course, WikiLeaks is analyzing documents and sees this document and said, what's this? Is this true? Is this valid? And of course, until we see it and know it, we don't know that it's 100% valid. But what Fred Burton has done in the past has been very reliable. And he's very well connected. So, for example, in another email, he says within 10 days after the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, he said, I can get the documents that were seized in that house from Osama bin Laden. So these guys have very close connections with U.S. intelligence. Other parts of these documents, in addition to this claim that there's an indictment, where they talk about Julian Assange. They talk about Julian Assange as a high-tech terrorist, that's what Fred Burton says, and that we have to bring him down the way we're bringing down Al-Qaeda.
No.
That's what they say. No. And the way we're going to do it, we're going to jail him wherever we can, we're going to cut off all his finances, and of course, that's what exactly what happened. They went, cut off MasterCard contributions to WikiLeaks, they cut off Visa donations to WikiLeaks, they cut off PayPal to WikiLeaks, and they're obviously going after them every way they can. So there's a lot of accuracy in this. But look, from my point of view, the fact that there might be, or it looks like there is, a sealed indictment against Julian Assange is just incredible to me. I mean, first of all, it would be, I think it's the first time in history that a U.S. journalist has actually been indicted for publishing classified documents that he himself didn't have access to as a classified person. So that's the first thing that's amazing. The second thing is the secrecy. If he's been indicted, it's by a secret grand jury sitting in Alexandria. It's a secret indictment, and it's secret to me, one of his
attorneys,
legal advisor. It's secret to Julian Assange. It's secret to WikiLeaks, but it's apparently not secret to a private security company that's like a backdoor for the U.S. Spy agencies.
Michael, how often are secret indictments brought and under what circumstance?
Well, the normal case of a secret indictment is when a person is not in custody and they're afraid if the person gets news of a secret indictment, they'll flee. Now, of course, Julian Assange is in custody. I mean, he is in custody. He has a bracelet on. He's under house arrest. He's under house arrest, essentially, in U.K.
Right.
Not house arrest, exactly, but he has to go back to his house every day at 6 o'clock.
Right.
He could, you know, meet people for
he's under supervision.
Lunch or something. But he has a bracelet that you can't get off. So the normal case would be when a person, not really Julian Assange, but when a person doesn't know about it, and then they do it in a sealed way before, so the person doesn't flee. Now, I think in this case, it may...
I was going to say, could this be because he's enjoyed such broad support, especially in the online communities, that the government, with their private arm, is afraid that there would be such a tremendous outcry and more support and perhaps more hacktivism, as they say?
There certainly is going to be hacktivism as a result of this. I actually think the explanation may be different. I mean, two things. One is let's hope it's not really an indictment and that the government isn't so crazy, Obama isn't so crazy and Holder aren't so crazy to make their legacy the prosecution of a person I consider to have exposed, along with Bradley Manning, if it's true, that he was the source.
Murder.
Serious war crimes, thousands of deaths in Iraq, the collateral murder video of the Reuters people being killed. So these people have done an amazing piece of work. And the idea
of public service.
And the idea, of course, this is what happens, of course, to whistleblowers. They first get, you know, the government in power or charge, Obama and Holder, go after them. And eventually
retaliation.
Right. And eventually they're seen as what they really are, which are people who have played the crucial role in trying to change a society in a positive direction. So what I think is actually going on, the reason we don't know about the indictment publicly is right now, of course, Julian Assange, within the next couple of weeks, is facing a court decision in England as to whether he will be extradited to Sweden for dealing with the sexual abuse and rape charges. We don't know how that's going to come out. But we do know there's a belief within many people that it will be easier for the United States to extradite Julian Assange from Sweden than it is from the UK. And to the extent the U.S. says there's already an indictment, it will feed the thoughts that they're just getting him to Sweden because then they're going to get their hands on him with an extradition coming immediately after he gets there,
right,
or shortly after he gets there. So my guess is they're not doing it because they just want this stuff to play out. He's in a place where he can't get out, and they don't want it to look like they're trying to get him to a place, the U.S. is trying to get him to a place where it's easier to extradite him. But it's worrisome. As I said, it's all secret. It's a clear violation of the First Amendment rights of journalists. And as I said, these people, Julian Assange is a hero for what he's able
to
do. Now, the question then comes up, well, what happened? What's with Bradley Manning and how does it relate? The claim is that Bradley Manning was the source for a significant amount of the documents of WikiLeaks, and Bradley Manning has been indicted, or charged rather, under a military law with 22 counts. He's facing a potential life in prison for what they claim was his violation of his security clearance and downloading, you know, millions of documents or hundreds of thousands from Army computers. Now, one of the charges, aiding the enemy, that's the one that carries the life sentence. What's off the table is the death penalty.
Right.
And that the prosecutor took off the table. That's not clear to me that, in fact, it's pretty clear that the judge could still give him the death penalty.
Oh.
I don't think the judge is limited, just like in a regular case.
Right.
You say, I'm not going to ask for more than 30 years, but
the judge has discretion to give
more. I would think the judge would have a discretion to give a death penalty. So I went to Bradley Manning's arraignment a week ago.
He was there.
And Bradley Manning was there. It's in a small, very small courtroom in Fort Meade. It's a weird courtroom.
It look like the one they showed in A Few Good Men?
This one is like an 8-foot, a low ceiling, square room, like four rows of benches on each in the back. Celotex, those ceilings with the little holes in them, you know.
Uh-huh.
A cheap industrial carpet.
Really?
And an antiseptic. I mean, like, it looks like a hospital
sterile
ward. Sterile is a better word. Yeah, it's like a sterile atmosphere.
Interesting.
And I sat there. There was only 10 spectators or so, and about 10.
Amazing.
Yeah, I was surprised. And only 10, because it was a short proceeding, so they didn't really call out for a lot. And 10 maybe media people. And we couldn't bring our...
They let the media in. That's good.
Well, they were. They normally keep in a separate room, but because there were so few spectators, they let media in.
Right.
They let two sketch artists in. None of us, media or anybody, can bring in BlackBerries or anything. It's completely... And Bradley Manning came in with his lawyer. It's very sad to see it. He's just 24 now. He's 22 when this alleged incident took place, or the going into the Army computers. And he didn't speak much. He has a very crew-cut hair with a dress uniform on. And he's sitting at one table with his civilian...
That's interesting. He wore a dress uniform.
Yeah, he did. He wore a dress uniform. Sitting with his civilian counsel. It wasn't camouflage.
Right.
And then a couple of military counsel. The civilian counsel is actually a former military counsel. Mm. And then there's, of course, all the brass who were prosecuting him. And they could barely stand up because there were so many of those ribbons on their chests. You're hearing the sort of antiseptic rendition of what motions are you going to file, what are you going to do, what about materials, and what government evidence is going to be relied on. And then they asked him whether he's going to plea, and he doesn't say anything. His lawyer gets up, David Coombs, and says, well, he's going to defer his plea, which means he's putting it off for another time. And I'm speculating
why.
I presume it has to do with if he ever gets a guilty plea or wants to plead guilty. I guess it probably is better if he didn't plead not guilty to begin with.
Right.
But I don't know. And, of course, one of the issues here related to Julian Assange is, and his lawyer said this, is the reason he's been charged so heavily, 22 counts, mm-hmm, life in prison, the reason he was tortured for the 9 months he was at Quantico, the reason he's still being treated like he is because they want him to testify against Julian Assange. They want to get a plea deal in which he agrees to testify. Now, that's not saying he knows anything about Julian Assange or that he has any idea who was at the end of whatever he allegedly did in terms of downloading.
But he's valuable to them in that capacity.
Right. And so my guess is the government's much more after Julian Assange and WikiLeaks than Bradley Manning. Yes, they think he violated the law. Yes, he was 22, and they didn't like what he did, and they have to punish him in their view. But, of course, my view is these are whistleblowers, and neither one should be punished.
Exactly.
I mean, these are classic...
And the National Lawyers Guild agrees with
and
that.
And look what
they're
heroes. Look what they've done out
right
there. I mean, look what they've done. When you look through those materials. It's incredible. I mean, what they've done. And so I look at both of these as people who we must support.
Right.
And when I hear journalists, like whether it's Bill Keller at the New York Times or others, sort of demeaning WikiLeaks or Julian Assange, or maybe sometimes Bradley Manning, I just say it's outrageous. This was the greatest journalism, the journalistic piece of work that's probably ever happened in this
country. It's just like the Pentagon Papers. Was anything listed in the emails to hint at what you've just posed about Manning in terms of his being a prospective witness against Assange?
No, not in the emails from Stratfor, which is the global investigation company. No, the lawyer at one of the hearings with Manning made a very strong plea that what's going on here is they're trying to pressure Manning into being a witness against Julian Assange. Because he said, look, there's 22 charges. I want you to reduce this to 3 charges. They all are around the same, these 3 issues. And then give them, the maximum penalty should be, I think he said, 10 years or something.
Right.
And, of course, as the charges went up the chain of command, they continue to be 22 charges. There continues to be life in prison. And I'm assuming that Bradley Manning doesn't know anything that would be of any value to the government. But yet they're insisting on this punitive, torture, trial that's a sham. I mean, the whole thing is
well, Michael,
terrible.
To me, it's clear. It's akin to the Lynn Stewart harsh sentencing where the government really needs to send a message to others who might follow in their footsteps. So the message is, do this, and you're going to be given the book.
I think that's right. I mean, I think you're right, Heidi. But what's outrageous to me about it, and I had this image, I think I may have mentioned to you earlier, if I were a sketch artist of what could happen, what it felt like in that antiseptic courtroom with Manning. Because here, what he allegedly did was actually reveal thousands of more deaths in Iraq, in Afghanistan, torture in the prisons in Iraq, the helicopter video, the killing of the 2 Reuters journalists, and then after that, the shooting of children in a van. And that we're in this antiseptic junk courtroom in which none of this is there. And so the image I have is of people in the pews should be the dead. They should be the 2 Reuters journalists. They
the
should
real
be
victims.
The children, the real victims. And the people where Bradley Manning is should be our president, should be our war machine, should be those who started the Iraq war, the Afghan war, and that's who should be in that courtroom. And its mute victims, in my view, are lining the walls of that courtroom saying, government of the United States, you are just doing the wrong thing.
But Michael, you're reminding me that it's in these times when the government commits such atrocities that activists often try to bring the so-called necessity defense in courtroom. And that is when an activist says to the jurors and the judge, what I did, usually an act of civil disobedience, was the lesser of an atrocity that the government's committing. I did this to bring attention, and it was my only recourse after we tried other things. And some brave judges will entertain or at least listen to a necessity defense. And that affords the opportunity to get the story, as you're talking about, into the public. At least the jurors can hear it and the news media. Why we did this, because so many people were being killed at war. Unfortunately, I think we had seeing a wave of fewer judges allowing the necessity defense. And it's a shame because each of these stories would probably change public opinion.
It's a really interesting question you're raising. The 2 things it reminds me. One is the defense lawyer for Bradley Manning is not taking a political defense at this point. He's taking the defense that Bradley Manning was psychologically upset, disturbed, was going through issues around his gender, that the military shouldn't have taken him to let him go to Iraq with the issues he had. And in some way, he's just pleading for leniency from the court, saying, you can look at this, but this is more about his psychological state than his politics. I happen not to think that gets true, but who am I to second guess a lawyer who thinks he may be able to get the best deal for Bradley Manning he can? I don't know whether having someone like me and or you or us doing a political defense on necessity would benefit Bradley Manning or not. I think it would, in my own view. I think these things, when you put forth the truth or why they're really done, that it does cause, ultimately, not immediately, some change in perception of what you've done. And interestingly, at the end of the court hearing, There were only 10 of us spectators. One guy was there who had been in jail. He was like a Plowshares type or a Berrigan type. He'd been in jail in Baltimore in the 70s because he, along with the Berrigans, or one of the Berrigans, poured blood on files of the draft.
Right.
And was the first one to do it before any of it. And he went to jail for a number of years. And he's sitting in the courtroom, and just as we're leaving, he yells out, "Isn't it the obligation of soldiers to disclose war crimes?" And that's really what you're saying. And you have to ask yourself, let's say you're Bradley Manning sitting there, and you come across the video of the collateral murder of the Reuters journalists. The U.S. has held that back. They won't give it to anybody. And it shows what many of us would say is a murder of two journalists, and then continuing shooting and killing afterwards. You have no way to go your chain of command. You can forget that in this military. I mean, you get,
right.
That doesn't work. So there's nothing you can do. So what can you do about war crimes if you're a person who cares about what your government is doing? You reveal it. You download it. You give it to WikiLeaks or some other outlet. I'm not saying he did that. It hasn't been proven yet. But certainly you could see, and it gets into your exactly what you're saying, Heidi, your justification defense. I did this because, first, I'm obligated to report war crimes. And secondly, it was justified in violating the law, this BS classification law, to disclose war crimes to the American public and the world because I want them to stop. It's a good defense in my view. But, of course, he's taking a different defense and not saying that's the wrong decision for him. I'm just saying that there are different ways you could go
here. And that's
here.
His choice.
But it could be for us on the outside to say, which it is, the Bradley Manning Support Network does take the position that he's a whistleblower and he must be protected and all charges should be dismissed, with which I wholeheartedly agree.
Michael, a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Jake Ratner and a key organizer from Immokalee Workers in Florida. And today marks an important day.
Yes, it was Elbin Perez, who is an Immokalee worker, one of the organizers, along with my son. And my son has been going throughout Florida organizing for a major event against Publix supermarkets. Publix supermarkets are the biggest markets in Florida and in the Southeast. And the demands of the Coalition for Immokalee Workers are a penny a pound, that they sign an agreement which will also force the monitoring of abuses in the fields. The coalition has won already against Whole Foods. They've won against Trader Joe's. They've won against all the big chains, including Taco Bell, McDonald's, etc. And now, really, in what I consider to be a difficult one, but I think as they've won everyone, they'll win this one, it's a protest with regard to public supermarkets.
There's something special about this protest, Michael. What are they doing exactly?
Well, they're fasting. What's interesting, in front of a supermarket where there's all this food, there's going to be some courageous people, a number of them, fasting. There'll be probably over 50 or 100. A number of them will be workers from the coalition who, as they said on our interview, they've unfortunately, because of their low incomes, have had a fast in their lives before. But whether they'll have had a fast for 5 days like this, it's a long fast. It'll have religious people. It'll have food activists, etc., in front of the Publix headquarters in Lakeland, Florida.
And this will go on 24 hours. It'll go on round the clock.
It's 24 hours. It ends on Saturday, March 10th. It begins March 5th, Monday. Today, as we're broadcasting in many places. And it ends March 10th, Saturday. Jake Ratner will be there. I'll be there. Many people from the Coalition for Immokalee Workers will be there. And if you're in Florida or nearby and want to do some of the best farm worker organizing and support in the country, probably the best, go to Lakeland, Florida, and join. You don't have to fast. You can just be there for solidarity. In fact, Carrie Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy's daughter, will be there. And in her statement, she says, on March 10th, that's the Saturday when the fast is over, we rededicate ourselves to bringing dignity to U.S. agriculture and real lasting respect for human rights to our food system.
Now, Michael, as the fast is going on, will there be behind-the-scenes negotiation with members of the Publix's, administration?
We have to go to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers website, just type it into a search engine, and you'll find it, to see what the status of negotiations, if any? I know there's been efforts by people like the Rabbis for Human Rights USA, by Protestant and Catholic set, to try and meet with the public's people. And they so far have had a sporadic series of meetings. Whether there's been yet an official negotiation with CIW, I don't know yet. And hopefully, if there hasn't been, this five-day fast and protest will bring publics to the table.
Well, exactly what I was going to say is this will also raise consciousness in the general public, people who were shopping there.
Publix supermarkets are everywhere. If you don't shop at Publix, it's very difficult to find a market. You can go to Whole Foods, but of course Whole Foods is more expensive. You can't just buy all your regular, you know, rice, etc. at Whole Foods. People have to go to Publix, or they do. There's not a lot of alternatives. But Publix also trades on a good name. It's a privately owned supermarket, but it claims to be very good to everybody, have a good name, etc. And so I think that this campaign, not that it will necessarily affect the public so much economically at the beginning, but it will call into question Publix's claims that it is good or fair to workers.
And reminder, Michael, we're talking a penny a pound.
And when you see how hard these tomato pickers work, the harvester, I mean, it's backbreaking work. I mean, it's backbreaking. And they're talking about a penny a pound. They make on average in a year with these heavy buckets, they make on average $11,000 a year or $12,000. If there's an increase of penny a pound, their salaries could increase as much as $3,000 or $4,000, which would give them a $15,000 salary. Still, you know, barely able to keep food on the table, but it's a big difference. It's a 30% raise for these people, for the Immokalee workers.
Well, good luck next week. Will you be fasting?
I wish you wouldn't have asked that. Okay. I actually, maybe. I'm going down on March 8th in the evening, and so it's really only a whole day of fasting for me. So it's like Yom Kippur for me for one day, except I don't really fast on Yom Kippur. But it's like Yom Kippur, or the Jewish holiday where people fast. So it's one day, although it's the night also. So I might. And I know some other friends are coming down, and they say they're going to fast. But we'll see. And don't say I can lose the pounds, Heidi.
I wasn't going to say
you
it.
Were. You were looking at my stomach. No. I saw it. I saw you sneaking. This wouldn't hurt Michael to fast. Wouldn't hurt him at all. But I'm really excited going down. As I said, I'm, of course, very proud of my son, who's working for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and doing incredible, incredible organizing.
Now, Jake's done a wonderful job, and we wish you all the best of luck.
And we will try. I'll be tweeting from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
How do we follow you, Michael?
Go to @ just left, one word, JUSTLEFT. And please do. You'll get regular reports on what's happening with the Coalition for Immokalee Workers, as well as the work that the Center for Constitutional Rights and I do on everything from BDS to WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, etc. So it's @justleft.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. For archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
our listeners know, you follow Mumia's case closely, you visit, and you also update our listeners as to what's going on with Mumia. At this point, of course, he has a life sentence. He's no longer threatened by death. Still very, very serious. I mean, that's the life in jail. And there are some actions planned, I know, around Mumia. Can you just tell our listeners what's going on?
Well, as listeners may know, April 24th is Mumia's birthday. He's actually turning 58 this year.
That's amazing. He's 58 years old. How long has he been in jail?
30 years, Michael.
He went in at 28 years old.
That's right.
So listeners, think about what you were doing. Some of you may only be 28, but think about what you were doing at 28, though you were 58, and what your life has been like. And think about Mumia, and under the threat of death for most of that.
Exactly. And so, as happens every year, supporters usually organize an event. This year, there's going to be a huge event in Washington, D.C., called Occupy the Justice Department.
Wow, that's fabulous.
Isn't it? And we'll put a flyer up on our website. We'll put a link to the organizing website for that, which is going to be launched by the time this program airs. And basically, it's going to be a large action in which several individuals, we're hoping prominent writers and journalists and artists who support Mumia, are going to engage in civil disobedience. And then there will be an action for people who don't want to get arrested. But the point is to draw attention to really a lot of inactions on the part of the U.S. Justice Department and Eric Holder into not investigating classic claims for decades of police corruption, prosecutorial misconduct, and even judicial corruption in Philadelphia.
Now, that's interesting to me because I know friends of ours, guild lawyers, Karas and Radovsky is the firm, actually had a lawsuit against the police department and got it put into receivership in the 70s. But I guess that worked maybe for a while, but it certainly seems to have failed to work
and
on a permanent fix.
That's right, Michael. There was also United States Department of Justice investigation decades ago. The problem is we still hear of rampant corruption of, I think people might have heard of the so-called Dirty 30, the 39th Precinct, where many cases were thrown out due to police corruption in the last several years. However, I think there's 10 or 12 men who remain on death row. They let everyone go whose convictions were tainted by these bad officers, except for those who were convicted of homicide, essentially.
Amazing. That's terrible.
But,
they let other people out, but even though it's the same 30th precinct, that's the craziest thing I ever heard.
It is. And so we're hoping that this action will draw national attention to a very corrupt city in the nation.
April 24th is the date, and it's a good way for all of us to be in Washington and to mark Mumia's birthday, as well as the utter injustice, both with Mumia and with the Philadelphia Police Department and, quote, justice system. Last week here on Law & Disorder, we brought you a segment on what was happening in Egypt with regard to the U.S. NGOs, International Republican Institute, and the National Democratic Institute, as well as Freedom House. Those organizations are funded by the United States to, quote, do democracy work in Egypt. The Egyptian prosecutor has brought charges against them and had forbidden seven Americans who were living in Egypt at the time from leaving the country. One of them is the son of Ray LaHood, the U.S. Transportation Secretary. His son, Sam LaHood, head of the International Republican Institute, took refuge in the U.S. Embassy along with the others. Well, the update on this story is the Egyptians have allowed the Americans to leave the embassy, and there's a chartered plane waiting on the runway to take them out of Egypt. As a condition of their leaving, each of the seven will have to post significant bail, possibly as much as $300,000, and promise to come back to the country. I presume that despite the high bail and their promise to come back, they won't be coming back to Egypt anytime soon. It's not that I think they'll jump bail or break their promise to come back. I think the U.S. will continue to apply the pressure it already has, the threat to take away all or part of the $1.3 billion it gives Egypt in aid, particularly aid to the Egyptian military. What happened here when you talk to or What happened here, according to some Egyptians, is that despite the claim that their court system was going to be more independent under Mubarak, the court system folded under U.S. pressure. It didn't fold easily. The judges who actually were in charge of the case did not fold, but were ordered to release the people on bail. They refused and were told by the chief judge they had to recuse themselves from the case. The chief judge, who was obviously bending to political pressure, then went ahead and released the Americans. The Office of the Egyptian Public Prosecutor issued a statement that said he did not agree with the decision to release the Americans. The quote that was put into the New York Times that he said is quite remarkable. Quote, "Could this be? I go out to eat some salad and come back to find that Egypt has knelt." In other words, Egypt has bowed to the pressure of the United States. Last week, human rights lawyers in the Supreme Court of the United States argued a very, very important case for the question of whether corporations, oil companies and others, could be held liable for gross human rights violations, such as torture, genocide, and the like. The case is called Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Shell Petroleum, and it concerns drilling for oil in Nigeria. The plaintiffs are people who assert that their relatives, husbands, children, etc., were tortured or killed as a result of Shell's cooperation with the Nigerian military as a way of pushing back opposition to the oil drilling. Well, the case is of great importance. For many years now, the Center for Constitutional Rights and other human rights advocates have brought cases against both corporations and individuals for what they do overseas that violate fundamental norms of human rights, torture and the like. The Supreme Court has previously upheld the right to bring such suits against individuals who commit such atrocities outside the United States. So, for example, we sued a man named Hector Gramajo for genocide in Guatemala. We've sued Haitian dictators for torture, similar kinds of cases all over the world. We've also been successful in some corporate cases, most of them by settlement. But this is the first time the Supreme Court has ever heard a case asking whether corporations should be prohibited from violating human rights norms just as individuals are. Listen again to that. The question is, should corporations be bound by human rights norms? And if so, can they be sued in American courts? Well, we were hopeful in this case that the court would go in our direction. Of course, the court has gotten more conservative, but we did win the case against individuals. And as one of our vice presidents said, Peter Weiss, who wrote an op-ed in the Times, if corporations can give money away the way individuals can, why aren't they also obligated to obey human rights obligations? Well, unfortunately, the argument seems to have gone badly. The headline of a blog that I respect a great deal, SCOTUS blog, Supreme Court of the United States blog, headlined the argument's recap with "Downhill from the Start." It was started by lawyers for the human rights advocates. And the first question or the second question out of the mouth of Paul Kennedy, who was a middle swingman on the court, not a right winger, was that he told Paul Hoffman, the lawyer arguing, that your entire case is in jeopardy. And from that point on, the lawyers for the human rights plaintiffs had to argue uphill. The big problem the Supreme Court has really are two. People like Kennedy have a problem with saying, well, under international law, it doesn't say you can sue corporations. Yeah, our domestic law, you can argue maybe it does, but isn't international law what tells us whether corporations can be sued internationally? And of course, it's true. There is apparently no international law one way or another saying corporations can be sued internationally. But Paul Hoffman argued, but our domestic law does allow it, so it should be allowed, or our domestic law appears to allow it and it should be allowed. Didn't seem convincing to the court. Then a couple of the conservative justices, Justice Alito, for example, made a surprising statement. Quote, "What business does a case like that, the one we're talking about here, suing a oil company overseas for killing people in Nigeria, What business does a case like that have in the courts of the United States? There's no connection to the United States whatsoever. So Justice Alito and others are claiming that even though these corporations are violating fundamental internationally protected human rights, that the courts of the United States have no right to consider them because none of the conduct took place in the United States. He, of course, leaves aside the fact that the way jurisdiction was gotten over Shell Petroleum, which is incorporated in England, in the Netherlands, and in Nigeria, the way the jurisdiction was gotten over Shell Petroleum is because Shell has an office in New York. So we sued, or the suit was against Shell in New York, and then through them we went after the Shell various subsidiaries who were engaged allegedly in the torture. But from the way the argument went, it doesn't look good. What's shocking about it, really shocking, is when it comes to giving corporations every right in the world to influence our elections by giving millions and millions of dollars, the Supreme Court lines up on their side. What's striking about the argument that took place in Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Shell is the deference or the protection the court wanted to give to corporations, wanted to make sure that corporations couldn't be sued for human rights violations. In some way, I guess that's consistent with their ruling a couple of years ago in Citizens United, which gave corporations an open door to give millions and millions and millions of dollars to fund elections. At the end of the game, corporations can't be sued, even if they commit genocide, but they can give millions to right-wing and other candidates, or Democrats or anyone, who will protect corporations in what they do, whether it's oil drilling in Nigeria or fracking throughout the United States. So our Supreme Court has really gone to the dark side.
Last month, a judge in Olympia, Washington, dismissed a lawsuit tailored to force the Olympia Food Co-op to rescind its boycott of Israeli goods. The judge ruled that the lawsuit, brought by opponents of the boycott, violated a Washington state law designed to prevent abusive lawsuits aimed at suppressing lawful public participation. Interestingly, an investigation by Electronic Intifada had unearthed that the lawsuit against individuals with the Food Co-op board was also planned in collusion with a national anti-Palestinian organization called Stand With Us that was working with the Israeli government. Lawyers with the Center for Constitutional Rights argued that the lawsuit qualified as a SLAP, that stands for Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation. SLAPs target the constitutional rights of free speech and petition in connection with an issue of public concern. We're joined today by CCR Senior Staff Attorney Maria LaHood to talk more about this lawsuit.
Maria LaHood, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Maria, I can't tell you how thrilled I was, just thrilled, to see that you guys out in Olympia, Washington, were successful in staving off a lawsuit, that tried to stop the co-op from implementing a policy of boycott, divestment, and sanction. To me, it's one of the great things that's happened in the last while, because there's been such an assault on people involved in BDS. But why don't you take us back a little bit? Tell us, what happened? What's the Olympia Food Co-op? What did they do? And unravel what happened next.
Okay. Well, yeah, we're thrilled too. The Olympia Food Co-op is a nonprofit in Olympia, Washington, that not only makes good food accessible to more people, but also encourages economic and social justice in other ways. So it has a long history of doing social justice work, including adopting boycotts. But in 2010, the board decided to boycott Israeli goods by consensus. A few months after that, there was a co-op election, and three of the five plaintiffs who ended up bringing the lawsuit, who were members of the co-op, you know, the co-op has about 22,000 members, they ran for the election opposing the boycott, and they lost. They ran for the board, but so they on an anti-boycott agenda, but they were not voted in by the members.
Now, the board is what decided on the
board is who decided
on the BDS. Now, what did they boycott, actually?
So, basically, they boycotted Israeli goods, and they decided to also divest from any Israel investments.
Now, what kind of goods were there from Israel?
There were gluten-free ice cream cones. They did have an exception for something like Peace Oil, which is an Israeli-Palestinian project, so they continued to carry that. It's not like it affected very much of the inventory at all. I think it was maybe 0.075% or something. But obviously it was, you know, had symbolic significance, enough so that the five plaintiffs decided to send a letter to the board promising litigation that would be complicated, burdensome, and expensive if the board didn't end the boycott.
So this is what happens. They do the boycott. Three people run for the board who were opposed to the boycott. Those people lose, and then they send a letter to the board, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both to the current board at the time and the board that actually enacted the boycott.
Saying, essentially, we're going to sue you guys unless you withdraw.
Unless you end the boycott. The board didn't do so, but it reminded the plaintiffs that the bylaws of the co-op actually permit them to bring the issue to a membership vote. All they need to do is get 300 member signatures of the 22,000 members to bring it to a vote. But the plaintiffs refused, and then they decided to sue.
So rather than go to the procedures that were allowed under the bylaws, they decided just to sue. Who did they sue?
They sued 16 current and former board members of the co-op, who are all volunteers, by the way.
So they sued them personally for money damages?
Yeah, for money damages and to end the boycott. And they purported to sue them on behalf of the co-op, on behalf of the 22,000 people.
Is there a name for this kind of lawsuit?
Well, we call it a slap suit.
S-L-A-P-P, right?
Yeah, that's a strategic lawsuit against public participation.
Say it again slower.
Slap. Strategic lawsuit against public participation.
Okay.
And about half of the states in the United States have actually enacted anti-slap laws in order to deter the abusive use of courts, chill free speech, like this case.
So was there an anti-slap statute in Washington?
Yes, Washington has an anti-slap statute that was actually just also passed in 2010. And essentially it provides for a motion to strike the lawsuit if you can show that it's directed toward public participation on a matter of public concern, and if the plaintiffs can't show that they're likely to prevail. If you win, you actually get attorney's fees, costs, and sanctions under the statute.
So this went on. They did file the lawsuit in the end, right?
Yes, they did sue.
The 16 people you said.
Yeah, 16 of the current and former board members of the co-op.
And that was how long ago?
They brought that in September.
And then what happened after that?
So then CCR got involved, as well as lawyers from Davis, Wright, and Tremaine, and then CCR Cooperating Council, to represent the board members, and decided to file an anti-slap motion, as well as a motion to dismiss. And then plaintiffs were also seeking discovery, which, of course, they had promised. You know, they started out serving 200 pages of discovery on all 16 defendants and trying to depose all 16 defendants. And then after we filed the anti-slap motion, which actually stays discovery, they sought to depose three of the defendants as well as additional document requests. We challenged that discovery request. And all of this was heard by Judge McPhee in Thurston County in Washington State last Thursday.
Okay, now before you get to last Thursday, I have a couple of background questions. One is Olympia, Washington. What is that place?
Well, Olympia, Washington is a great place in Washington. You know, that's where Evergreen College is. That's also where...
A very progressive college, right?
Right. And that's also where Rachel Corrie's family is from.
Remind our listeners who Rachel Corrie was.
Rachel Corrie was a 23-year-old who was actually at Evergreen College, and she went to Palestine with the International Solidarity Movement and was trying to protect a home from demolition while the family was inside, and she was run over and killed by a D9 Caterpillar bulldozer.
Olympia at least has, I mean, because of Rachel Corrie and Evergreen, obviously has some progressive tendencies as a town, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
That's Olympia. Now, there's a group that I've heard mentioned called Stand With Us.
Right.
Did that come up by this point?
Well, Stand With Us has been... It's basically a national anti-BDS organization. And the lawsuit against the co-op board members was actually identified by Stand With Us as one of its projects months before the case was even filed. Stand With Us also did produce and post online an anti-BDS video with four of the five plaintiffs in the case. They described themselves as an international organization ensuring that Israel's side of the story is told. And they also have apparently connections as well to the Israeli government.
Right. Do you know anything about that, or is it just that we have any evidence of that?
Well, there has been evidence of meetings that have taken place with certain folks, as well as I think someone from the Israeli government itself has said they're interested in this BDS activity in the United States and making it stop, basically.
So now, in my view, from my distance looking at it, this becomes a key test case, really, of BDS, the abilities of boards to say we want to have BDS, the opposition that, you know, groups have to it, and it all culminates, you know, a week or so ago when you go out to Olympia, Washington, and begin to argue the case regarding whether this is a slap suit, whether it should be dismissed, et cetera. So why don't you give us a sense of what happened?
The hearing was last Thursday. It was really a great turnout. They had to move us to a bigger courtroom. There were over 100 people there. It lasted a couple hours. The judge on Thursday denied plaintiff's motion for discovery, which was great, and then, you know, heard arguments not only on the anti-slap motion, but plaintiffs had actually also challenged the constitutionality of the anti-slap statute in Washington. So he heard arguments on that as well. And because the anti-slap statute requires the court to issue a decision within 7 days, the judge said, come back on Monday for a decision.
How amazing. I mean, yeah. The whole thing, just the anti-slap statute just sounds incredible, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So then on Monday, he issued his decision that, in fact, this lawsuit did challenge public participation. So it did fall under the anti-slap statute.
What is it meant by, before you get to the next, what is meant by public participation?
Well, it essentially means any kind of free speech activity or petitioning activity or lawful conduct, you know, in accordance with free speech rights that is on a matter of public concern.
The public participation here, I presume, is the vote of the board to decide to have a BDS campaign
Israel. Right, to boycott. I mean, you know, boycotts are constitutionally protected under the First Amendment. This kind of suit is exactly what the anti-slap statute was meant to address.
Very exciting. So now go into more of his ruling.
So, I mean, you know, he basically found that it not only fell under the anti-slap statute, but they didn't have, you know, they weren't likely to prevail based on their claims. He noted plaintiffs were actually arguing that there's, you know, that the co-op boycott policy requires staff to make the decision, not the board, and that it has to be a nationally recognized movement, which they claim it wasn't. We argued that the board, under the bylaws, has the authority to adopt any policy, essentially, it wants that promotes the co-op's mission. The judge basically found that, yes, the board did have the authority, and that the boycott policy was ambiguous at best. But he did say that he believed that it was a nationally recognized movement.
That, I thought, was very significant. When I saw you or somebody tweet about that,
yeah,
I just said, oh, my gosh, he just found that the BDS movement is a nationally recognized movement.
Right, right. It is obviously based on an international campaign that does include the United States, that is a call for BDS. It's great. I mean, I'm thrilled for the co-op board.
Well, you haven't finished, Maria, with the decision. So you win.
They
throws out the lawsuit against the BDS, against the board and BDS.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finds that it was a slap suit.
He finds it was a slap suit.
And then what happens now?
So he, you know, basically the statute provides for attorney's fees. So our attorney's fees will be, you know, should be paid by plaintiffs as well as the costs. And then it actually provides for $10,000 in sanctions.
Against each of the plaintiffs?
We have argued and cases have found that each of the defendants, each of the 16 defendants.
Oh, each of the defendants, I'm sorry.
Is entitled to $10,000. He didn't rule on that.
Oh, because you got the defendants are obviously the members of the co-op, and so each of them gets $10,000. I mean, they're the board members.
They're the board members, right. Also members, but they're the board members who were sued. So basically he said, you know, go and try to sort of negotiate or settle this as far as what kind of damages should be paid. It's been reported that plaintiff's attorney said he's going to appeal. There is a, you know, a right of appeal in the anti-SLAPP statute, so we'll see what happens with that.
Well, extremely, extremely exciting. Really, just a major victory.
Yeah.
So the next thing that has to happen is there has to be some negotiations about what the money costs will be, et cetera.
Yeah, it seems like it. And then we'll need to go back before the court to finalize those issues.
Now, did the Corys come to the trial?
They came. They were at the hearing, yeah.
So how do you see the significance of this in terms of the overall BDS movement?
Well, I think it's critical. I mean, it sends, you know, the victory here sends a message to folks that you cannot sue to chill free speech on issues like Palestinian human rights. You know, we've seen sort of a growing movement to suppress Palestinian advocacy through lawsuits and otherwise, and this is a great victory for not only free speech, but also for human rights advocacy.
Well, congratulations, Maria. I have one little question. In New York, we have a Park Slope Food Co-op,
uh-huh.
and they're considering BDS, and I think they're going to have a vote of the membership in a month or so. Do you have any updates on that or any
Well, yeah,
thoughts
the vote,
about that?
There's actually going to be a vote March 27th, but it's a vote of the membership on whether to have a vote on whether to boycott Israeli goods. It's just a preliminary vote, but a critical one as well.
It's a huge co-op. I think it's like 16,000 members in Park Slope, New York, right?
Right, right.
And do we have a SLAPP statute in New York?
There is a New York anti-SLAPP statute, which I need to become more familiar with.
Well, hopefully you won't. Hopefully you'll get a vote, BDS will be imposed, and there won't be a lawsuit. But
yeah, hopefully.
We'll see what happens. But we wish the Park Slope people good luck, and hopefully there won't be an appeal in the Olympia Washington case. But if there is, I'm sure we'll prevail. And Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights was one of the lawyers litigating this case. Terrific. Congratulations.
Great. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Maria. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.